Rat.
Rose.
No.
Hello, Star Trek fans, and welcome back to Warp Trails. This is the RetroZap Podcast Network show devoted to Star Trek. I'm your host, Dennis Keithley, and with me, as always, is my wife, co-host, and most favorite Star Trek fan, Beth.
Welcome back, everybody. We missed you.
Yeah, it's been a while since, what did we have last, Lower Decks?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
So, it's been like 18 months since Discovery, I believe.
2 years and like a month. I just looked it up. It ended in March 17th. Of 2022 was the last episode. But yeah, so as Beth was just suggesting, we are back to cover the fifth and final season of Star Trek Discovery with a discussion of the first two episodes, which aired on the same day. They're called Red Directive and Under the Twin Moons. As always, this will be a full spoiler discussion. So before we get into the details, we've had two episodes, Beth. What are you thinking so far?
I'm happy with it. I always like how New Trek seems to have different focuses, and Discovery has always been more of the relationship Star Trek, and it was good to be back with those characters. How about you?
I liked it. I'm enjoying it. I am glad that they've decided to get away from the mystery box format of the show by giving us the MacGuffin and the importance of it right up front, as opposed to waiting to the last two episodes to reveal it to us, only for us to get lit down by it. this is one that ties back into the Next Generation, which is pretty cool. So we'll get to that in just a second. But I got to say, as far as Star Trek Discovery goes, one of the things I appreciate about this is that the show has its footing. I feel like it's taken a while, the first season to the second season to the third. They're constantly changing the dynamic of the show, and they just skipped over that this time. I mean, there's a few little relationship dynamic things going on, but we don't have to deal with Burnham being a traitor again. We don't have to deal with them settling into the 32nd century again. We are where they need to be, and they're capable of taking missions and doing things on behalf of Starfleet, which is a nice touch.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so we're going to start by talking about the first episode, and then we'll inevitably end up talking about things in the second episode at the same time, because there's a lot of things that spill over between the two of them. This first one's called Red Directive, and it is the start of our mission when Kovich is a Red Directive mission. And I know you'd looked this up earlier, and this is something new for Star Trek. We haven't heard anything about it before. Is that correct?
That is correct. Red directives are new to us, which actually I appreciate, because the idea that there would be nothing new in protocols and things like that in the 32nd century would feel very, I don't want to say dishonest, but disingenuous. So I don't mind that there's a, directive that we haven't heard of before. And they don't, to your point about, not spending the whole season on MacGuffins, they don't really spend a whole lot of time being secretive about what a red directive is. It basically means it's super classified and no one's telling you nothing.
Exactly. But so this mission involves a Romulan ship that's 800 years old that they've discovered, and there's something aboard it that is of great importance to the safety of Starfleet and the Federation. And the Discovery is the ship that can get there fastest, which is an interesting thing that happens here. They are formally retiring the Spore Drive program. We find this out at a banquet that happens at the beginning of the episode in favor of some sort of a pathway drive, which kind of puts Stamets into a little bit of a funk there during the reception.
Yes, it's pretty obvious what his theme is going to be this season. Very much on the nose that he is just, going to think about his legacy all season, which I don't mind. I like Paul. I like Paul when he has this is legacy is very important, and your legacy is important and something that everyone should think about. But in terms of it also is a little frivolous, which I kind of like. It's very Stamets was extremely self-centered in the first season and sort of and has come away since that, and the idea that it is ending with him obsessing about his legacy, it feels very true to Paul in a way that I like.
Indeed. But so the Discovery is going after this, and then we got another ship, the Antares, which is going to meet them there, and this is going to be under the captain of under the command of Captain Raynor, I should say. And so when they get there, they've been beaten to the punch by a couple of people that we'll come to know as couriers, Maul and Locke. Maul is a human woman who looks a bit like Shin Hati from Ahsoka. And Locke is an unknown alien race. And like I said, they are couriers. They get aboard the Rimland ship and they're looking for what they can scavenge and sell. And they come across this big Rimland puzzle box. So what'd you think about our, I don't want to call them villains, but our antagonists so far in this episode?
Well, it's funny that you call out Maul looking like the woman from Ahsoka. I think Locke looks like Discovery Season 1 Klingons.
Oh, good call.
I mean, I don't think that's what he is. Don't, please, that is not my theory. But when I saw him, I was like, oh, huh.
I'm glad you said that because it does look familiar and I've been racking my brain trying to figure out where we've seen him before, but you're right. It did. And you know, there hasn't been Klingons that much in the way of Klingons in Discovery since they got to the future there. And they specifically call out other potential aliens that might buy this technology, this Romulan technology that's getting discovered, as the Breen Imperium, the Tholians, and the Orions. And there's no mention of Klingons there either. And of course, the Romulans and the Vulcans have combined there on Navarre, is you know, where they're located now. So obviously they, and they're part of the Federation again. So that's not even an issue there. But yeah, so they get away with this Romulan mystery box. We do get to see the desiccated body of Velik, the Romulan scientist that's there. And then they head off for to this world called Kamau, where there is, well, I guess you should back up. They have to figure out where they went. So Burnham says, I know a guy, and they go get Cleveland Booker. And we get a rather awkward reunion. And apparently they have not talked at all since the end of season 4, which is apparently was about 6 months ago, according to the timeline. And this is a big thing over these two episodes about who should have called who when, the status of the relationship. At one point, Culber in the second episode is asking Booker, how are you? And he starts to talk about what he's doing. And Booker Culber calls him out. It's like, that's what you're doing. I asked you how you're doing. And he still won't talk about it other than to say that there's a lot to process there. So what are you thinking about the Booker and Burnham relationship?
I think Discovery did not do enough to set up the fact that they haven't spoken for a very long time. Because from a viewer point of view, Book was in the absolute last episode of Discovery. And he's in the, and he's not all that long into the first episode. So he's at the end of season 4 and he's at the beginning of season 5. I love the actor who plays Book. I love Book's character. I'm glad he's back. But you know what? Even with the score swelling and telling me that this is a real moment between him and Michael, I didn't feel it because I wasn't there with them. It hadn't been 3 episodes and I was wondering what was going on with Book. I hadn't wondered the and in fact, at the party, they reference like, oh, she hasn't talked about him for months. And I'm like, so Book has never not been off my mind. So I think this is a Discovery misstep. I want those two to be together. I'm just not feeling the conflict because as far as I can tell, because I'm not there with them.
Sure. Sure. I that's a valid point. I think they're, but they really lean into it once they bring him back. I mean, it comes over, you know, it comes up time and again that you should have called me. No, you should have called me. And then we get through the big action sequence at the end of this episode, like, we should have called each other. And, you know, it right. kind of lingers over the entire second episode as well.
No, it definitely lingers over the episode. And if you, I mean, and if you want to have conflict between Book and Burnham, I'm down for it. I would just do a little bit. I wouldn't do the, it's weird to be around you because we haven't spoken for a while. It should be the, you know, I think it would have been a little, I don't know. I don't want to be in the writer's room because it would be too hard. But the idea that, you know, he got community service for an attempted genocide and he probably is not doing well in the court of public opinion, and having a captain of Starfleet romantically interested with somebody who is probably a bit of a pariah in the court of public opinion, to me would be a more interesting conflict than they hadn't spoken for 6 months and no one's sure how the cat's doing.
Good point. Good point. This gets us to the scene that this whole thing opens up with, which is Michael Burnham in her spacesuit on the back of a spaceship at warp trying to disable its engines. Which,
is there any more Burnham-y Burnham moment ever in the history of Burnham?
Wow. Yeah. I mean, you know, ride 'em cowgirl when it comes down to it there. She, incredible scene. And this is where we get our introduction to Captain Rayner as the Antares pulls up at warp speed and tries to lock a tractor on. And the problem is it's going to pull both those ships apart, and we're dealing with a ship that he doesn't have this pathway drive that they're talking about that, you know, might have helped out in this situation. And finally, Burnham has to convince him to let the ship go because they need to get what they've stolen. And he reluctantly agrees to do so. And then they fall out of warp speed. And then Maul and Locke, I keep wanting to say Locke and Mac, but anyway, Maul and Locke basically deploy all these probes that go off to warp on their own and create all these false warp signatures so that they can't be tracked, at least not quickly. And so, you know, we get, or like I said, we get our introduction to Captain Rayner. He's a bit cantankerous, I think.
I love him.
Okay. I was just about to ask you what you thought about him overall after we got him through two episodes.
All the stuff about him said he was going to give you like Shaw vibes from Picard. And yes, grumpy old man. I'm not getting Shaw vibes, but that idea. And what I really like about Rayner, and I have every reason to believe he's going to stick around after the first two episodes. What I really like about what they're doing with this season of Star Trek after Discovery, after talking about how the book and Burnham conflict is making me nuts, I'm going to take a minute to really praise what they're doing here. They have always taken Burnham and Saru and really the crew of Discovery, and while they're adapting to the future, they have always maintained that old style, original series idea that the captain and the first officer go on every mission. Right? That's very old school. It would be very easy to not do that. But then you would have to really mutate Captain Burnham in a way that wouldn't work. So what they've done here in a way that I really like is, so they take Rayner, right, who says, like, I'm dealing with burn technology. Like, the idea that he's also kind of got that frontier vibe, which is much more in line with Burnham than, you know, Picard and TNG and that idea. So that those two are really going to work together, but they've both got this rough and tumble original series, like on the frontier, winging it kind of mentality. And I really do like it.
Yeah. And I like it too. This is a character that was rubbing me the wrong way when we first meet him in the first episode. But by the end of the second episode, I started liking him quite a bit. And so this is one of these moments we're going to talk about both episodes at the same time. We've got this whole notion that Saru may or may not be leaving the Discovery because he's been offered this position by President Rylak to be an ambassador to some of these smaller worlds. And we'll have to talk about this in a second. And he's very tempted to take the position because it'll keep him at Starfleet headquarters and near President Tarina of Navarre. And eventually she asks him to marry her, and which, you know, puts the whole thing over the edge. And so Burnham's going to need a new number one. And she starts trying to get some advice from Saru about this, about, you know, picking a new number one. And a couple things come out. There's a lot of discussions. You're talking about this series being the relationship series. And I think you nailed it right on the head when you said that, because it's not just the Burnham book relationship. It's the Burnham Saru relationship. I mean, it's like a central focus of the second episode about how they were kind of sandpaper and grit type relationship when she first came aboard Discovery. But then Saru says that, yeah, I've been impressed with how you've evolved and you've grown in this role and it's inspired me. And, you know, and then you know, Burnham returns that by saying, you know, you gave me a second chance and thanks him for that. And so she ultimately gets to pay it forward by giving Rainer a second chance for something we'll talk about here in just a second, which I thought was a pretty neat way to not want to say close out, but bring full circle the story arc that started in season one of Discovery.
Yeah, no, I agree. And then last season, it looked like Saru was going to take an ambassador position and he was also not long for Starfleet. So that continued, I really liked. And I actually really liked, if we're going to sort of jump around, which we're doing, the scene where he's talking to Tarina about that and that sort of save that she does, where she's like, well, it's, you shouldn't think about me when mm-hmm. you're thinking about your career. And he just gets this look on her face and she's like, look, we love each other very much, but it's not logical. I really liked that. I thought that was very, I think if she wasn't who she was, I wouldn't have liked it as much, but mm-hmm. that was such a like Vulcan Romulan trying to deal with emotions and the sort of merging of the Romulan Vulcan mentality. I really appreciated it and enjoyed it quite a bit.
No, I'm with you. I'm not a big shipper when it comes down to these type of things. However, I have enjoyed watching their relationship because Saru will let his guard down and then wear his emotions on his sleeve. And as you were just saying, Tarina is supposed to come from this logic culture where they're not supposed to do that. And so she thought she was being like tremendously supportive by saying, you should evaluate what's best for you. Don't, you know, it was really saying, he's like, don't worry about me. We're good. But he was crestfallen.
Right.
Because right. The way she said it, is that, like you said, he had to completely like, oh, hold on. You know, no, we love each other very much. And that's not what I'm trying to say. So that's what makes that relationship fun to watch for me, is how they kind of kept missing in the prior season on getting this relationship off on the right foot. And then they finally got together by the end. And now they're still kind of stumbling a bit this season.
Right. But it's much more, I agree with you 100%. There's still some stumbling, but you can see there's been progress mm-hmm. as opposed to like, we're exactly where we were in season four. It's like, no, they're beginning to figure it out. There's always going to be some stumbles, but at the end of the day, the two of them are learning how to do some quality communication. Good to see.
Indeed. Okay, so they get to Kamau and they find this person that Book knows who's actually an android. It's Fred, who looks like a descendant of Data and Locke. It's a Soong series android and mm-hmm. apparently dozens of generations old. And he manages to unlock the box and then reveal the scientist Velik's diary in there. Okay, before we discuss what we learn from this diary, what'd you think about Fred?
Oh God, Fred. I love Fred. I would like Fred to come back. And since there is actually an option, I mean he's pretty shot up, but anything is possible. I would love to see Fred come back. Fred was fun for me. And I think it was a good way to have a sort of strange character in terms of somebody who's really interested in very old tech, and you would sort of have to wonder why that was happening. But then there's this sort of fan goodwill when you see that Soong type android and you're like, oh, okay. And then he was fun, but what did you think?
I love how he was just Fred and everyone like said his name very like they put that emphasis on the end of it. Fred, not Fred Jones, not Fred Smith. It was just Fred. It was just something that was just like Data. You know, there wasn't a last name to be tossed around there. And so that, and I don't know, just an android named Fred tickled me for some reason. I thought that was a nice touch there. But like you point out, Maul and Locke get what they need out of him, which is he unlocked the box. He tries to give them a low ball offer to buy the diary. They don't take it. Then he essentially tries to seize it, which leads to the fight, which basically results in him getting shot up and effectively meets his demise.
Isn't that weird to you? I mean, I haven't pawned a lot in my life, so I have no idea what I'm talking about. But so they go in, they give him all this stuff. He opens the puzzle box. There's still no deal on the table. He opens the puzzle box, pulls out the puzzle box, opens the diary, reads the diary, memorizes the diary. The diary is now completely worthless to him. He knows exactly the contents of the diary. And then they make a deal. I was kept waiting for Mullen Locke to be like, okay, no. Okay, stop. Okay, now we have to talk about a deal. And it never happened until he lowballed them at the end.
To me, the appropriate sequence would have been, we've got this. Can you open? Yes, it's going to cost you. How much? $1,000. Fine. Opened it. Oh, it's a diary. Can you read it? Yes. How much? It's going to cost you. How much? Another $1,000. Okay, fine. And then he reads it. You know, what is it? And then maybe there's where shenanigans come in. But you're right. The way that the whole thing went down seemed to be a little bit out of order. And that seemed to be a failing on Mullen Locke's part there. Not getting these things up and agreements made up front and just kind of letting him do his thing with the puzzle. And, you know, when he was so obviously trying to pull one over on them.
I mean, and that may be the point, because Mull's like, that's not how we do business. And I was like, girl, you have not been doing business right this whole time. And that may be sort of the point, mm-hmm. that she's not nearly as good at this as she thinks she is. And that could come up in later episodes. But I was just like, okay.
Right. Yeah. So we're not going to get to all the details here. We just don't have time. But this is followed up by what essentially is a pursuit on that. They're trying to get away. They're heading for some caves. They're going to fly through them in their ship. And they're being pursued by Booker, Burnham, and Rayner on the speeders. It very much seemed like a Star Wars speeder bike chase to me there. You can tell I got Star Wars in the brain, but it is what it is. And ultimately, Rayner gets the idea, well, we're going to blow up their bomb first so they can't get through there. And then my ship will catch them in orbit. Except for what ends up happening is Mullen Locke send a torpedo down to this mountain, which creates an avalanche, which is going to wipe out the settlement that's on this neutral world. And they have to make a decision, either use their ships to stop the avalanche and let Mullen Locke go, or they complete this Red Directive mission. And Burnham gets her way, says that this is now the primary mission. We got to save this people. We're on a neutral world, and they successfully stop the avalanche. This is where I got a little concerned about Rayner here. But what was your take on this entire scene?
Okay, first of all, it's just cool. The CG was cool. The CGI was very cool in the scene. And I got a little confused about where the shields were coming from. Were they coming off the bikes, or were they coming off the communicators?
I have no idea.
Okay. I watched it twice and I'm still not sure. The only reason I'm asking is, and it adds for a little bit of drama that, you know, father and his son on the, I'm presuming, relationship there on the bikes that, you know, Burnham has to save at the last second, which was, you know, kind of cool. But I was like, wait, don't you guys have shields? Where are these shields coming from? Anywho, I don't think they've just, I mean, I think they're trying to show, you know, the difference between Burnham and Rayner. They'd done some earlier things with Kolvik where, you know, he was like, you can kill everybody. You can, you know, I don't care.
Kovic is very much about the Red Directive.
Right. So there was very much this, like, we are completely about the Red Directive and we don't care anything else. And in fact, Rayner actually says in the second episode that, you know, this is not his first Red Directive by any stretch of the imagination. I think that detail would have been a little more useful in the first episode to set that up. Mm-hmm. But clearly what happens in these Red Directives is that, you know, you do whatever you have to do in order to complete the mission. And that's just not what, I mean, Burnham says that, like, we will catch them later. This will happen again later. And I think it does make an interesting conflict between what happens if you, when you keep secrets and you don't tell people what's going on. Burnham would never, like, you know, our Discovery crew is never going to just go in and just kill everybody, but you really aren't going to get anybody to do something that they don't think is a good idea if they have no good reason to. And that's the problem with the Red Directive and keeping secrets.
Right. Yeah. And this is just a different type of Star Trek storytelling than I think we're used to, where they have to make a decision, or they're put in a place where they're told the mission is so important that you might even contemplate making this type of a sacrifice of all these thousands of, not, you know, I don't know how many people in that settlement, you know, of innocent lives in order to finish the mission, especially when they have no idea what it is that they're trying to recover. They just know it's a Red Directive and therefore it's super important there. In the past, you know, Prime Directive, Starfleet, Federation morality would be you save the innocent people and you don't even think twice about that. But they do. They get this all resolved. They save the town, and with a really cool shot of the two ships using their shields to protect everybody.
So cool.
Right. And Burnham, meanwhile, has contacted Tilly, and she is accessing or hacking a Federation database to get some information they need about what's going on, and security busts into her room and tries to stop her, and Vance shows up, and eventually it comes down to, he's like, you know, he wants to know what's going on as well, because he doesn't know what the Red Directive is. Like, well, it's a pity I didn't get here in time to stop you. And then you couple that with them being able to access Fred's memory, and Burnham now knows where they need to go. It's a planet called Lyrat, because it's got two moons that cast a shadow on it. And she uses that to blackmail Kovich into telling her what this is all about. And this is when we find out about the progenitors, you know, that how they went around. Basically, they are responsible for all the humanoid life across the galaxy. And this is a callback to, as you were saying earlier, that Star Trek The Next Generation episode, which is what, The Chase, I believe is what it was called.
And that's even a callback to even just sort of older Star Trek lore, that there's one, that there was always one big alien race that was the form of all, you know, sentient life in the galaxy, and that's why you could have human actors play everybody.
Mm-hmm. Convenient. And that. But the hope is that they're going to discover the source of the progenitor's power. Do you think that's actually going to happen this season?
It's an interesting potential, because no, I don't think they will. But that being said, as a potential, because the setup, as far as I can tell, is it's something of a, like, it feels like it could basically reset life on the entire universe. And that seems to be what the setup is. Mm. That basically, if you set it, it's like a Genesis device, but for the galaxy, as opposed to the, just a planet. Or is that not what your vibe was?
I wasn't certain what exactly they thought they were going to be getting if they acquired the progenitor's power, what exactly to it, because I'm not as versed in this as you are, so please correct me if I'm making any errors here, but it seemed to me the progenitors were powerful because they could shape life like this, the power creation, and Burnham says something about that in the second episode. He's like, let's go find the power creation. Very peppy moment for her. And then that seemed to be what the power is, and I could think of a lot of great uses of that, you know, cure genetic defects, cure cancers, cure all kinds of things, you create super races of people if you needed to, and that sort of thing. But your idea of a life-altering Genesis device for the entire galaxy is particularly intriguing. So we'll have to see. But yeah, it's definitely powerful, but I just can't. Wow, that'd be something if it actually fell into somebody's hands.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I guess it's to the second episode. I don't think we'll be spending nearly as much time discussing this, but they end up getting to Lyric. They discover a structure that's in the shadow of these two moons that are having an eclipse, and a strange coincidence. This is the day of the solar eclipse here in the United States, and you and I just happen to be in the path of totality, so we're going to check that out once we're done here. And there is this Promillion structure that they're going to go to, which happens to be protected by this strange field of electromagnetic energy, which prevents them from transporting down to the site. Instead, they have to hike there. They get intercepted by the Promillion defense system, which eventually they discover is powered by the same electromagnetic energy. And with a little help from Captain Rayner, Tilly and Adira figure out how to stop this whole thing. So a few tense moments with Saru and Burnham, where they have to decide who's going to potentially sacrifice themselves so the other one could shut things down. and it all works out. And then they get on to the next set of clues, and we'll talk about the last bits of the episode after we kind of discuss this some. So what did you think about the Indiana Jones style mission to discover the source of the or what's going on here on Lyrag?
I liked it. I liked especially at the end when they were looking for, you know, what the Romulan had left, and there was a lot of callbacks to the security and secrecy that was part of the Romulans back in that day. And I really did enjoy that, like, okay, we've got to think about, you know, and that was the theme, right, of the episode. Like, think about what the people you're trying to copy or follow or track, what they would do. So there was a lot of that vibe in it that I really liked. But what about you?
No, I enjoyed it. I appreciate what you were saying earlier, that this series is the relationship series, but they really are laying it on thick between Michael and Saru and Michael and Booker, all the relationship elements. I mean, how many times did Michael and Saru talk about the relationship and how impressed they were with each other and thanked each other for all their experiences and everything else that's going on? And Saru offering Michael advice, it felt like there was a good 3 or 4 minutes of that they might have been able to cut out of this episode if they wanted to, and we still would have ended up with all the same beats.
That is true, and I don't want to... I like Discovery. I don't love everything about Discovery. And one of the things I don't love about Discovery is actually in that first episode where they went around the crew. Mm-hmm. I was like, I can't remember your name. You're Linus, right? I don't know anything about you other than you're Linus. Reese, don't know much about you. Like, there were two or three people on the bridge crew. I was like, I don't remember you. Were you even there last season? And I find that disappointing, because you're right. There's so much depth to some of the relationships, and then some of the characters have almost nothing to do.
Yeah. Oo and Detmer, you know, our navigator and pilot of Discovery. Huge, huge roles on every other Star Trek series, but they really are lower end second tier characters in Discovery, which I think is a shame because they're both really cool. So okay, but yeah, to your point, they eventually disable the little probes that come flying out of the statue's eyes. Which is funny when they're in a panic talking to Tilly and Adira, like, you know, we're about to lose a foot. Wait a minute, who lost a foot? No, they're hiding under the statue's foot, and the probes are detonating themselves above the foot. And so I like that idea, and that's what gave me the whole Indiana Jones vibe. Just, you know, these ancient statues that have traps and buoy traps inside them. And then they do make it to the Promillion structure. And like you said, there's this old Romulan poem there. It's a Revlav is what they call it. And they're supposed to have 5 lines or 5 verses. They only find 4. So you point out, yeah, you know, friend, there's always a false entrance at the front. And then there's a back entrance, the true one. You know, so enemies come to the front, friends know to come to the back. And that's how they figure out how to look underneath in order to find all of this. And I did kind of like the, again, Indiana Jones misdirection. Maul and Locke would have only had the first 4 verses of the poem, so their staff would have been the wrong length, and they're headed off to Beta Zed. And meanwhile, they figure out that they need to go to Trill because they have the 5th verse of the poem.
Mm-hmm. No, I like that. I like that very much, too. I also liked, because Romulans, like Vulcans, are stronger than humans, and Saru is stronger than humans. So the idea that we needed, you know, the idea that the Romulans were taking advantage, and I don't even want to say taking advantage, but we're doing what they would do. Like, yes, if a Romulan's got a statue and they're going to try to fake it, it's like, yeah, I'll put it underneath and that's fine. And a couple of times where Saru was using his, you know, extra reflexes and extra strength and stuff to help the mission, I thought was very good. He was useful and important, and he needed to be there, as opposed to it was just sidekick to Michael, which I really appreciated.
Mm-hmm. And while all this is going on, Booker is trying to figure out Maul and Locke, and he knows they're couriers. He has this dark comm that he ends up using to communicate with them, and is basically trying to talk them into selling out, essentially, what they've got. They aren't going for it, but they you know, as they're threatening to hang up, he reveals who he is, Cleveland Booker, which gets a reaction out of Maul. And then he figures out, based on what was it, tattoo? Oh, birthmark that she had.
Birthmark.
That this was the daughter of his mentor, Cleveland Booker the Fourth. So now we've got, again, talk about relationships, you know, this past, you know, a ghost from the past, essentially, there for him. Has this intrigued you yet, or what do you think about that?
I'm not intrigued. I'm neutral on the subject. I do have to admit, the first, for a second, when it was like, oh, of course, Book knows Maul, I did roll my eyes a bit, but I'm interested in Maul and Locke. I think we're going to get more about them. I'm sort of hoping that they're a little more complicated than they have been so far.
Mm-hmm.
They've got potential, and I'm interested.
Yeah, I'm really with you on that. It's like, they could have done a bit more with them in that second episode, I think, to get us invested in them as our antagonists in this season. And so I'm hoping when the third episode rolls around, we get a bit more exposure to them to, you know, like I said, to get some sort of investment and make it, to either be intrigued, because at the moment, I'm kind of indifferent, I guess is what it comes down to about them.
Yeah, I don't think they're nearly as, I think by the end of the season, they will be working with the Discovery folks, and it will not be nearly as antagonistic as it is right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's get back to Captain Rayner. There is the inquiry that happens at the beginning of the episode. This is being led by President Rylak, and Burnham is there to testify at the inquiry, and she's being asked point blank whether she agreed with Rayner's decision to take the shot and blow up that bomb. And she is trying to be very diplomatic. You know, there's this code that Admiral Vance ended up kind of referencing earlier, you know, about not throwing your fellow officers under the bus, I should say. And, you know, she's trying not to cast any doubt on his judgment, you know, looking at his service, and he's a, you know, this officer, and he was doing what he thought was right. And so finally, Vance is like, you know, I can appreciate, you know, the unwritten rule that we're doing here, but you've been asked a direct question by the president in this inquiry. And so finally, and then Rayner even prods her. It's like, you know, you weren't afraid to express your opinion back there on Kamaw. And so that's when she says, it's like, no, I didn't agree with it. And
I thought that was nice of him to do that. He gave her permission, basically, in a way that was very much in character for him. That was like, tell her the truth. Did you think it was weird that Kovich wasn't there? I thought it was weird that Kovich wasn't there.
I hadn't thought about it until he asked.
Because when Rayner says, I know what this is politics. I was like, 100%, because Kovich is not in the room. You are not being defended. You are being set out to dry.
That's a very good point. Yeah. If Kovich had been there, this may have all turned out differently. But the other thing that keeps coming up here is that how this is a different world. They keep saying that. It's a different world. It's a different world. I mean, for no one is it more of a different world than it is for Burnham, because right. You know, 800 years out of time or more. But it took me a while to kind of grasp what they were talking about. Well, it's because the Federation has been coming back together. All these worlds that left it are now coming back in. And so now it's fragile. They have to be careful about what they're doing in other places. And so they can't be reckless. And I'm glad we talked about this, because now I'm starting to understand the tension a bit more between the Red Directive as a mission and what it is that Rylak is trying to do. And you're pointing out that Kovich wasn't there. I'm guessing Rylak has no idea about this Red Directive, what exactly this is behind this Red Directive. What do you think?
I think that, yes, I think the president is being kept out of the loop. And I think that's going to become a problem later, because Vance is somewhat aware, but he doesn't say anything about it either.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept thinking I was like, because, you know, Burnham's point, and I agree, was like, well, you know, it wasn't Rayner he didn't cause the avalanche. You know, he inspired, but did not, you know, 70% for the win. Yeah, I just thought it was really, really interesting. And I think they did a lot, set to your point, setting up the world, setting up the situation, setting up one of them. I think you're right that the main conflict is actually of this season is not going to be really Mull and Locke. I think it is going to be Red Directive versus this idea of a very of the politics of the Federation, especially as it is trying to recreate itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because when he shows up via hologram in the Discovery, because he's been listening in on a secure comm with everything that goes on, and he realizes Burnham and Saru are in trouble. And so he starts giving advice or in prodding Tilly and Adira about how to figure out how to stop the trap. He mentions like he's been in charge of 4 Red Directives and aided on 3 other. He's been involved like 7 total, I think is what he says. I can't remember the precise number, but it's kind of irrelevant. And so he really is, he's the soldier. How many, it's kind of a trope we hear in all these type of army movies. It's like, you know, the mission comes first, the mission comes first. And, you know, it's, that's what you got to do. And that is a different way, I think, of thinking from what we usually see in Star Trek, as I was alluding to earlier, where there is a prime directive and there is kind of a, you know, the oath of not doing harm when it comes down to it, just for the sake of your mission here. And it's not a wartime scenario either, where that you would be necessarily thinking along those lines. And so it costs him. At the end of the episode, Admiral Vance tells Burnham that he asked Rayner to take early retirement. You know, after 30 years in the chair, he's now being asked to take early retirement. And, you know, there's this allusion to second chances again, and it leads Michael to go to his quarters, and he's looking out at the, I guess it's the Discovery, and, or I couldn't tell if there's Discovery or the Grand Antares, doesn't really matter at the moment, but they're talking, and she keeps saying about all these things that he could have said at his hearing and he didn't. And she says, I want you to be my new number one. And he's got some doubts about it. And he says, I'm not going to be yes, man. She says, I'm counting on that. And I loved it how he like stood up real straight and then zipped up his uniform again.
His action jacket. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, what did you think about those closing moments around Rayner?
I liked it. I like Rayner. Saru's point was that Michael needed someone who would, a first officer who would, I'm going to just go with him because Rayner, but, you know, who would stand his ground. And that's what Rayner does. He will not be a yes man. But what we've seen with them working together already is that, I don't know that they work well together, but they work together and they make progress and get things done. It's going to be, you know, there will be some cowboy diplomacy. I wouldn't be shocked if that phrase actually gets used sometime this season, but yeah, I'm glad he's going to be around.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I said, I didn't care for him a lot in the first episode, but he really won me over in the second. And so I think this is, how do you feel about Saru leaving though? I mean, are we really not going to see him? Because last season, Tilly disappeared to go head up Starfleet Academy. And we didn't see much of her at all until, you know, there was that huge swath of episodes where she was gone. And then she showed up at the end of the season. And now they are seemingly doing something similar with Saru.
I think we will see Saru's wedding, and we won't see, there will be a few episodes where we don't see him. And it looks like we are getting Tilly this season, which I love Tilly. I want Tilly back, but I also want her to keep flirting with that guy, that lieutenant that she was flirting with at the academy. I do not want her separated from him. That was so cute.
Yeah. And that's the other thing we've got going on is that she is very frustrated as this, I'm sure what her title is, but at the academy, she doesn't feel like her students are grasping how to put the theory in action. You know, they're learning the stuff, but they, you know, she's talking about marooning them on an ice planet in order to get like, so they maybe get the point and stuff like that. What'd you think about that?
I love that even in the future, everyone is still having a kids these days moment. It was, you know, but the idea that, Adira makes a good point in that, you know, the tasks are the tasks and they are very concrete and doable. The mission can be a little vague as something to figure out. And I think Adira got through to Tilly when they said that to her. So, and I think that will be sort of Tilly's, we talked about Stamets, you know, journey of the season. I think this is Tilly's journey of the season to figure out how to teach students the very vague concept of what the mission is.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Adira there. I want to touch on her for just a second. Or
them.
Yeah, I keep getting that messed up. I couldn't remember what her pronouns were. Again, I did it wrong again. Couldn't remember what their pronouns are. They came off, I'm not sure I want to say this, I like them better in the brief amount of time we got so far this season with Adira than last season. And I think it's because we just tread so much of the same ground with Adira about being unsure of herself, being unsure of her relationship with Gray, being the Nyx Wesley crusher of Discovery in a way, you know, kind of the wonder kid. And instead, this time around, they seem to have more confidence when dealing with Tilly and everybody else, and being willing to be the sounding board, and even saying things like they were talking about Gray, the Trill, and how Gray's got that next generation android body or whatever has after happened to him last season, and Adira says that they kind of like being on their own. You know, everything that they've always been tied to Gray, and this is a change. And so there's some growth there, which I think has been absent for Adira a lot of the time.
Yeah, I agree. I think in the way that the Saru-Torino relationship has been making some progress, but is still not 100% solved, Adira is well on their way to figuring out who they are without Gray, without, you know, much of expectation, but they still need and have the support of Paul and Hugh. So yeah, I agree. I think the writers have gotten into a better vibe, or maybe the actor has gotten into a better vibe, or maybe both, of who Adira is. And I agree. They were a much more solid character, still very smart. And you're right, still much, but more self-confident in a way that was good to see.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, then I think that about brings us to the end of these two episodes. Anything else you want to touch on before we wrap it up?
We have to talk about Action Saru.
Oh, yes. Action Saru. Well, you brought it up, so tell us about it.
Oh, I just, apparently that's his nickname, Action Saru, which I thought was great. I actually wrote in my note, Danger Quills. I'm sure that's not what they're called, but I was very glad that he got to fire them at the drones. And I just think that's cool. I mean, we've talked about how characters have grown over the course of the five seasons, and I think Michael and Saru are the two that have grown the most. I don't know that season one Saru or season one of Michael, if they would meet their season five counterpoint, would recognize or even like who they are now. I like them better, both Saru and Michael.
Oh, absolutely.
But I think they've grown in a way that feels as legitimate as, like, as honest as it can. Like, yes, I've jumped bazillions of years into the future and all that kind of stuff. But feels reasonable and good. But when Saru was talking about, you know, how you used to be afraid of everything, I was like, oh my gosh, that's right, man.
Yeah. You were. That was such a huge, huge part of the show, that danger sense that he had, and, you know, the fear, and he was very nervous all the time. And now he's got this supreme confidence going there, but
since the coming of death. Yes. And now he's, you know, flicking quills at drones.
Yeah. Yeah. And there was, you know, that whole bit that came up because Booker is the one that brought it up. You know, I can't imagine Action Saru being chained to a desk, and Burnham had never heard that before. And then Burnham assumed that Booker was the one that came up with the nickname, when it was actually Commander Reno who did it. And, you know, and that just invited some more of the discussion of relationships, et cetera, that happened between Saru and Michael there. But yeah. And then he got an opportunity to put Action Saru into action. So,
yes, I was very happy. I mean, there was so much foreshadowing with Action Saru. We knew we were going to get action, or I knew we were going to get Action Saru. I did not know we were going to get it in that episode. So are they leaving his cabin, room, part, whatever you want, quarters, is just like a crazy greenhouse. Are they just, I guess they're keeping it that way?
I felt like that was an inconsistent. Yeah, I felt like that was an inconsistency between the first and the second episode, because in the first episode, they were talking about him resigning his position so he could take on this role as ambassador, and then he would be there at the Federation headquarters, Starfleet headquarters, whatever it is, and he'd be closer to Tarina. But Michael made it sound like he's going to be gone for some amount of months at the end, you know, when they were saying goodbye at the end of the episode, and that he was always going to be able to come back, and they were going to leave it just the way it was, which didn't make too much sense to me, because that would seem like that would be the quarters for the number one, the first officer of the ship.
Yeah, I mean, I get looking around that room, I wouldn't want to take that down either, even with the, you know, super technology, but.
Isn't he going to want to take it with him? It's his stuff.
It's his plants. He's like, you know, don't touch this plant when it's in bloom. I was like, maybe take the dangerous plant off the ship. I don't
yeah,
know.
Exactly. Yeah. All right. Well, then, this has been one of our longer than usual episodes, but we'll go ahead and wrap it up here with our discussion of the first two episodes of season 5 of Discovery. We will be back soon with a discussion of episode 3. But before we go, Beth, you want to remind everybody what our social media contacts are?
Sure. As much as we are on social media, we can be reached on Twitter/X at Warp Trails, Instagram and Facebook at Warp Trails Pod. But honestly, guys, if you want to reach out and talk to us in a social media universe, the best way to do it is to come to the RetroZap Discord server, find the Warp Trails room, and discuss Star Trek with us.
All right.
But
so, just remind everybody that our show is part of the RetroZap Podcast Network. If you're listening to us on the RetroZap Podcast feed, over on RetroZap.com, you can find a bunch of other great podcasts covering everything from collecting, video games, superheroes, Star Wars, and a whole lot more. And with that, we'll just say thanks for joining us, everyone. Live long and prosper, and we'll talk to you next time.
70% for the win.